Good morning, and welcome to KRFY, the Tuesday edition of Community Conversations Playing as the Morning Show, with your hosts Phil Huff and Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil. How are you doing?
Wonderful this morning. It's nice that it's actually turning fall. The cooler days and the shorter days, well, maybe not the shorter days so much, but the cooler days are bringing out sweaters and backyard fires. It's the season we can actually cook out again.
And it's one other thing, Phil, and you know, because you received a little bag of them in your office today, it's the season of the golden chanterelle, although I can't tell you where I found them, because if I told you all, I would have to kill you.
Well, thank you for the goodies. And sure. The best part is I'll get to enjoy all of them because Deb doesn't like mushrooms.
Yes, we know. So they're all for you, Phil. I hope you enjoy them.
And we have a quite interesting guest today with a lot of topics to cover, and one of them will be some of the administration of Idaho's lands, at least. And so why don't we launch into that, Julie?
Yes, I'd be happy to. This morning, we're going a little bit off of our topic of recreation, but for a good reason, we were able to secure an interview with Chad Hoke. And Chad, you are the chief deputy for the Secretary of State, who is Lawrence Denny. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Julie, and hi, Phil, and thanks for having me on the show.
You bet.
Thank you, Chad. We'd love to hear just a little bit about your background. I think a lot of folks in Idaho are familiar with the Office of the Secretary of State, and because that's one that is an elected position, they're somewhat visible, but we don't usually hear about the assistant. So tell us about what you do and how long you've been there and how you got engaged with it all.
Certainly. Well, thank you. I've been with the Secretary of State's office as a state employee now, actually, for 5 years. With the office for a little over six, and just in fact had my 5 year anniversary as a state employee about 2 weeks ago. So just coming past that milestone. Prior to that, I actually worked with one of Secretary Denny's daughters in a tech startup here in Boise back in 2005, 2006. Following that enjoyable endeavor, if you will, but it was a very difficult endeavor. I traveling around, flew over 100,000 miles domestically in 1 year, and really, it was a really hard time on my family. So we took a change of careers, if you will, and I left the state for about 3 years. Did do some traveling with my family. Also ended up working out of Texas for about 2 years, and then came back to the state of Idaho shortly after Secretary Denny had been elected as the Secretary of State. During that time, I was stayed in contact with family and worked on campaigns for the Secretary. When that started, he was still Speaker of the House. So when I got back, he had just taken office, and he had some questions that he was struggling to try and get his arms around in the office. Knowing my background and knowing that I'd worked as a consultant before, he asked if I would come in and take a look at specifically the IT department and try and give him an assessment of what kind of the state of the state, if you will, for the Secretary of State's office was back in 2015, 2016. And so we took that project. I took that project on. I gave him the report. He looked at it. Said, do you know how to fix it? And I said, well, I can sure make a good swing at it. And he pushed the report back to me and said, let's get started. That was 6 years ago. And in the time since, we've gone through and really renovated the entirety of the Secretary of State's office, from the corporate division to the elections division, going through how we handle and budget and go through our fiscal processes in the office. And then even some how we file and retain our documents in our Gov Services division. So kind of done a full overhaul of the office in the last 6 years. And then, of course, as you mentioned earlier, also had the pleasure of serving now as our state land board staffer for the Secretary of State's office. Each one of the constitutional officers has a appointee that sits on the land board staff. And we go through and brief and work through each one of the land board meeting agenda details in the weeks before the actual land board meetings, and then brief our individual principals on those different topics.
There's a number of things there we want to unpack, and I think an important focus right now in the fall here will be the elections. And we'll save that maybe for second up, because a lot of folks who run small businesses or nonprofits will, when they think of the Secretary of State's office, think about all the work that goes into administering the business side of Idaho. And of course, a lot of information there. And when I think IT, I think of how much it must take to manage and handle all of that business data, and much of it very sensitive. So tell us a little bit about that side of the work you do first.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is, you know, the office of the Secretary of State and all the different variable pieces of it are kind of like the joke of how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time. So whatever bites you want to take along the way here, let me know. On the IT side, you know, back in 2015, 2016, when Secretary first got there, of course, the office had been run at that time for 42 years by a combination of Secretary of State Ben Usursa and Secretary Pete Santarusa. And the legacy of both of those gentlemen stretching over 42 years, where we also had a tremendous amount just in the industry of IT, tremendous amount of IT innovation that had happened. The state hadn't necessarily kept up with that at that point. So one of the first tasks that Secretary Denny had to undertake was figuring out how was he going to manage and modernize the IT department to give us the foundation on which we'd be able to modernize the other divisions of the office, like the corporate division, the elections division. So we started in that endeavor. We tried to talk to other aspects of the state. We looked at the Department of Admin and looked to see if we could get help from there. And in fact, found out that our IT department was too much of a risk for them to bring into their portfolio. So we had to solve the problem ourselves was ultimately what we decided. In the time since, the landscape of IT has changed tremendously. January 2017, the Department of Homeland Security made a declaration that brought elections infrastructure into the umbrella known as critical infrastructure in the United States. And that created a whole new category of IT challenges. It meant that Secretary Denny and myself, within months of that declaration, would end up going through a process to get security clearances. And in fact, just today, we went through a secure briefing with the Department of Homeland Security here in Boise, reflecting back on the November 2020 elections and forecasting that international spectrum forward into 2022 and 2024.
Yeah, well, that brings me to a question that I know you'd like to talk about, and that is about free and fair elections here in the, well, of course, in the country, but also in the state. And I have to think that IT is just a hugely important part of keeping our elections free and fair. And why don't you tell us about, we all know why it's important, but how do you do it? How does it happen in Idaho?
Well, it's certainly not a one-man show in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, in Idaho, it's a several-man show. And that's really a tribute to the IT department that we have at the Secretary of State's office. Fortunately, over the course of the last several years, we've been able to put in front of, and the legislature has accepted several different budgetary amendments and created some positions within the Secretary of State's office. We've also found some efficiencies in our corporate division that allowed us to reduce the number of personnel we were using there and move some of that personnel, some of those what we call in state government FTEs, full-time employees, or FTPs, full-time personnel, and put them into cyber-specific positions. So we've actually grown the IT department without growing overall. When we first got there in 2015, 16, I think we were 28 people. Now we're at 29. So not a huge growth in that overall. But keeping elections secure is a collective responsibility of both the 44 elected county clerks in the state of Idaho, and they do a tremendous job. It's a matter of them working with their teams to actually execute elections out in the field, and then providing them the systems, which is where the Secretary of State comes in, upon which they can do that.
So let's step back from focusing on just the IT part, because the office really oversees the entirety of the election process. And give us maybe the 101 on how elections are run in Idaho.
So So, sir, that's a great comment. I mean, really, in Idaho, the election 101 comes down to one person, one vote on a paper ballot. And that's one of the real reasons that we can trust Idaho's elections, is we always fall back to a paper ballot that can be counted, that can be audited, if that's what needs to be done. If we use electronic tabulation machines, those electronic tabulation machines are not connected to the internet. They're not connected to the internet because we don't have machines certified that have the capacity to make that connection. So you might hear, oh, well, you could Bluetooth to that. Well, that requires an antenna inside the machine. And if it's not there, you can try and Bluetooth all you want, but you're not going to pick up a signal when it's, I mean, there's not, it's a two-way communication tool. We have a very simple and straightforward process for absentee voting. We don't use, you heard a lot of conversation in the last election about mail-in ballots and mail-in voting. And because we are neighbors with both Oregon and Washington, and they have a high rate of mail-out ballots, in Idaho, we only send a ballot to a person that requests them. And that request is made either online through our online system, but that requires your state-issued ID, or it's made in writing and your signature is compared. So those are procedures, with the exception of the online registration and online request. These are procedures that have been tried and true in Idaho since the early 70s, about 1974.
And so online voter registration and online requests for ballots. Tell us a little bit about some of the services for voters. Those two are somewhat obvious, but tell us a little bit about how and why they are such a great service, and how folks can use them to check to see if they're registered.
Well, one of the great things, thank you for that question. One of the great things that we have here in Idaho is a website called voteidaho.gov. And it's really your central place online for voter information and even voter education. And we'll touch on that voter education in just a moment. But through voteidaho.gov, you can find out where your polling location is. If you're registered to vote, you can update that voter registration as long as you have a state-issued ID or a state-issued driver's license, because we require that driver's license number along with some other identifying information in order to access the voter file for an individual. With those pieces, you can go in, find that information. You can also find Idaho voter education videos that we just started producing over the course of this last year. And in those videos, we actually break down all the elements, all the individual pieces, into 2-2.5 minute chunks, ranging from the registration process to how we keep the voter roll clean so that we know that individuals that are no longer qualified to vote are not on the Idaho voter roll, and then how the tabulation process works. I mean, there's right now, I think we've got 25 or so videos up online. The entire project will end somewhere around 40.
Yeah, so, that's great. I was going to, something I think is interesting is, I believe if I'm correct, I think I did this. Are you able to designate your affiliation online, let folks know whether Republican, Independent, Democrat?
Absolutely. As long as you have, in Idaho, changing your party affiliation it's equivalent to re-registering to vote, effectively. You're just making that designation technically on a new voter registration card. So as long as you meet the requirements, that state issued ID that we keep talking about, as long as you have that number, you're able to get in and make those modifications. As long as you're within the windows and time parameters, because that does close down immediately before an election.
Let's talk a little about that, because we do have an election coming up here now in a little less than a month. And like a lot of communities in Idaho, we've seen a surge of new folks moving in the last year and a half. And some of them are probably registered. Some of them might be listening now and going, oh, I think I should register. Tell them how they can do it and what timelines they need to adhere to.
You can register. One of the great things about Idaho, you can register right up to election day. There's different procedures, and if you want to get the full summary of this, go to our voter education series, look at our registration section, and each one of those videos will detail both the different timelines and requirements for the different formats of registering. You can register online, You can register in person at your county clerk's office. You can get a registration form and mail it to the county clerk's office. Don't mail it to the Secretary of State. We don't do the registrations. All we'll end up doing is turning around and sending it back to your county clerk. And then finally, as mentioned, with the proper identification, you can register on election day at the polls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there a deadline for online registration? Do you have to do that pretty soon? I don't know.
There is a deadline for online registration, but I will defer to the online registration video to make sure that that is exactly correct.
No problem.
Yeah, I think that's a great source. The online voter information site is fabulous. It's well laid out and provides many detailed information pieces. And highly encourage listeners to also check out, while we're speaking about elections, the Bonner County Elections Office maintains a very active website with information on all the upcoming elections and processes, links back to the state. It's a great central resource. Speaking of Bonner County, so bringing all this close to home, we have had in the last week here a partial recount, an audit, I suppose it would be called, of the last election, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. Tell us a little bit about the role of the Secretary of State's office in that and the process itself.
Certainly. So functionally, was it an audit? Was it a recount? It was really just a manual review of the ballots. I mean, yes, we were counting them. It was not an official recount or an official audit because we weren't looking to disprove anything specifically around Idaho's election process and the certification that had already been made official back in November. What we were doing was looking to either prove or disprove allegations that had been made blanketed across the state of Idaho in a spreadsheet called The Big Lie. And this spreadsheet simply alleged that every county in Idaho had been mechanically, electronically manipulated in such a way as to take votes away from one candidate and place them in the column of another candidate. And ironically, every one of those shifts or manipulations was about 8.4%. Now, what's really interesting about this is if you look at the state of Idaho, we have 7 counties that don't have any electronic processes in their counting procedures. They literally make marks with a pen or pencil in a paper ledger book known as a tally book. So it's really curious how you go about manipulating that completely non-electronic process. And some might say, well, then it's when it's transferred. Well, same thing goes. We get a unofficial electronic, we might get an email or something else from that county, but the official results for that county are transferred to us by mail, effectively. I mean, they send an unofficial copy to us the night of the election. We put up unofficial results, but it's not until 7 days later when they actually canvass and they sign a document and they send us that official document that canvass is completed, and then the county or the state goes through another 7 days called certification. To Bonner County, more specifically, Bonner County represented a opportunity to look at an Idaho county where every ballot processed through a machine, but also through only one specific machine. If you go to a larger county like Kootenai, or maybe, you know, Kootenai has 3 different tabulators. So in order to properly review Kootenai County, you'd have to look at all 3 machines and make sure that all 3 machines had a sample of ballots that had run through them that you counted and compared in order to validate the accuracy there. With Bonner County, we had 32 precincts. Every one of those 32 precincts had gone through that one system. And with that, we were able to say we could randomly draw a certain number of those 32 precincts. We established a threshold limit of 7,000 ballots, and that was done based on statistics and looking at confidence factors and less than 1% or margin of error, give or take 0.2%, et cetera. And ultimately, we said we're going to look at greater than 7,000 ballots, however many precincts that ends up being as we randomly draw them. We ended up with 8 precincts, a little over 7,700 ballots counted. That represented 7,800 ballots drawn when you consider overvotes, undervotes, things of that nature.
Okay, and just to be clear for the listeners, which election was this? Which candidates?
This was the specifically the only thing we were counting were the presidential candidates in the November 2020 presidential election. And again, very important to note, this was not, regardless of what we found or what the outcome may have been, I would say other than it being significantly differentiated finding, this was not done so that we could add one vote or take one vote away for any candidate. It was done to prove or disprove the allegation for Bonner County that there were 2,244 votes that had been switched from one candidate over to another in terms of difference.
So what was the outcome? What did it demonstrate or prove or disprove?
At the end of 8 precincts and, like I said, roughly 7,700 ballots, we came down to within 9 total ballots of the count that had originally been recorded on election night. There was an 8 ballot differential on the Trump side. There was a 1 ballot differential on the Biden side. But we also had a series of ballots that we came across as we were counting that were very, very, very lightly marked. And by that, I mean almost imperceptible unless you looked at them and realized that that same very light mark was in every type of race. We looked at the congressional race, and we looked at some of the down ballot races as well and saw that same mark. So somewhere there was a very, very faint pen or something that was being used to mark those ballots. And we saw anywhere from 6 or 7, 8 of those ballots across the course of the day. Our decision at that point was that we were going to count those, but had that been election night and had they not been read by the scanner and had the judges on election night that are bipartisan judges looking at those made a different decision than what we did on the review, that right there accounts for, it gets you to within one vote out of 7,700.
Yeah, that's great. That's great news. And what great accounting you're doing.
So it validates that the system is working. And for listeners, many of whom have probably followed the news locally may or may not have followed the rest of the news around the state, but there were a couple of other counties who went through a similar process recently. Tell us a little more about what they found.
We did the same thing in much smaller counties. Again, we had mentioned earlier some of these counties that don't have any electronic processes at all. So we actually said, well, the almost the lowest hanging fruit in this situation is going to be the smallest counties in the state. So we started at number 44 and we started working backwards. We looked at 44 and 43, that would have been Clark and Camas County, but we couldn't get the two of them scheduled on the same day. And we were trying to be as efficient as possible. So we looked at number 42, which was Butte County. We could make 42, 43 work on the same day. So we went ahead and scheduled that, told Clark County, thank you, but we'll pass on their roughly 375 ballots. And we upped our ante, if you will, by going to 1400 ballots in Butte County. And in those counties, kind of the same scenario. In Camas County, literally 674 ballots originally recorded. We counted 675. Was the error on election day or on our team on the review? Could have been either. So again, not a significant finding there. The margin of error in that case, 0.114 or 14%, somewhere in there. When we were in Butte County, we originally came up, we were looking like we were 20 ballots short of the total count that we were going to need in terms of the total ballots cast. We looked back in the boxes, the storage boxes, and found some ballots that come off of an adaptive voting machine. They had used them at the end of the night, they were running out of ballots. So they had some folks vote on the adaptive voting machine, even though they didn't necessarily need to use the machine. And those ballots print out on a piece of paper about the size of an absentee envelope, and they were stuck to the absentee envelope. So we found 11 of the 20 in that case and left with the perception that we were still missing 9 ballots. Because they didn't like that finding, the staff of Butte County went back in and looked in the days subsequent and looked back at their tally books. They looked back at their poll books. They looked at their audit slips and they started going through and doing a reconcile. And what they found is that they had actually had a math error in the major races where the tally books show at the top, if you look across the top of them, they say 110, you know, they'll say 120, 130, 140 as you make your hash marks. And they had attributed the 160 or 170 column with a couple of marks in it as 173 instead of 163. that total had transferred, then that transferred over to the tap to the total sheet. And as a result, they carried forward a 10 vote on all the larger races at a 10 vote differential. They were able to find that. They backed that up. They actually sent us a letter to that effect to make sure that that was documented. But it's something that now they'll be able to train to make sure they don't have that clerical error in one precinct as they go forward. So in the end, I mean, every one of these ended up coming around to something that allows the clerk to look at the processes, find something that maybe they didn't see, not a huge finding, but it just lets them fine tune how they train, how they prepare their poll workers, and how they get ready to go for, as we said, you know, we have elections coming up right now in November as we look at our municipal elections coming forward.
So it sounds like the items that were found, you might say, were idiosyncratic, not systemic.
Absolutely. I mean, there was nothing systemic. There was nothing scalable. They all simply roll down to, and you find this when you have humans in a system, human error, whether it's clerical error, whether it's training error, whether there's always ways that you can zero in on those and try and do a little better. But these are far from the kind of systemic, scaled, widespread fraud allegations that kind of have been running around of late.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's reassuring to those of us who are voters here in the state of Idaho. And I'm so happy to hear that you dug in and did some partial recounts or audits, however you'd like to describe them. Is there anything else that would be important for you to talk about today, Chad, before the upcoming election relating to your work with elections and the Secretary of State's office?
Thanks, Julie. I think it's super important for people to understand that this recount, while its visibility may have been higher than normal, and that largely because of the scope of the allegation that was being made, the process of looking into reports by the Secretary of State is not uncommon at all. We get campaign finance allegations. We get voter fraud. In fact, I think we followed up on 41 potential cases of voter fraud within the days following the election, just on things that were flagged on election day, election night. And many of those cases end up going to prosecution, some even as far as felony prosecution. So it's not atypical. And the thing that to take away from that is, if you see something on election night that you're not comfortable with, that you don't understand, find an election official, find your county clerk, bring that to their attention, and let the Secretary of State's office do the job.
Very, very good advice. Well, so as we wrap up the elections portion of the interview, I know our listeners want to hear more. Julie and I often talk about land and conservation and North Idaho lifestyle things. So the work of the land board is really important, and yet it's one that goes largely unnoticed by a lot of the public. So maybe begin with just a brief overview of what the land board does, what its roles and responsibilities in managing Idaho's lands are.
Certainly. Thank you. The Idaho Department of Lands is the office of the state that's responsible for managing what was originally 3.5 million acres of state endowment trust lands. It was land that was given to the state at statehood for public schools, for the Capital Commission, for the state hospitals, different things of that nature. And all of these different endowments, there's seven of them in total, I believe, all these different endowments have these lands that are directly associated to them. The dollar values derived from those lands, whether that be from timber or whether it be from cattle leasing, leasing for range land that happens on it, whether it be for recreational leases that occur on them, all of the revenues go to the benefit of the beneficiaries of that trust. So public schools trust being the largest one, Department of Lands revenue going into the public schools endowment is the first money that goes into the public schools fund every fiscal year. So that's down now to, because of sell-offs and trade-offs and things that happened, consolidations and whatnot that happened over the initial years of Idaho statehood, that's now at 2.5 million acres of land across the state. And that turns and generates almost $100 million in annual revenues that are paid out, not just what goes into the investments and things that are in the endowment, but the actual payouts that go to the beneficiaries on an annual basis, the largest, of course, being public schools.
Yeah. And does that cover a large portion of the school's budgets?
Well, it doesn't cover a large portion of the school's budget, but what's important to understand is it's the first money in. So as those budgets are set, any money that can be generated and any revenue that's placed into that fund by the Department of Lands and by the Land Board is money that then does not have to come from tax revenues. And that's a super important thing to consider, especially when you consider that the way that the department manages those funds and the investments that play off of them is such that we have multiple years of reserves to carry us through the downtimes as well. And it's designed in a way that it will never back off. It's not, we're having a heyday year, so we're going to put out $100 million this year, but next time it's only going to be 75 or 80. Anytime the disbursement is increased, it's done with an eye towards being able to sustain that all the way through the reserves, which sit now at 7 years.
And is there a mandate that the state must keep all of this land, or is it sold at times?
The mandate that's in play, there are times when it's sold. We've seen auctions happen around the lakes, Payette Lake and Priest Lake in specific. Sometimes it's traded. There's been a lot of press of late with land trades that were being considered around the McCall area. Occasionally we're able to purchase lands. We have revenues from lands that we've sold, like those auctions I just mentioned, that we use to reinvest in purchasing and acquiring lands. And occasionally, like we mentioned, there's a trade that might be considered either between another state entity or Forest Service or otherwise. So several different ways it can go up or down, but ultimately the big key is that all of the lands, all of the assets have to be managed for the long-term benefit of the beneficiaries of the trust.
Yeah, and that's set by the Constitution and the original arrangements when Idaho became a state. So it's work that's carried on well over 100 years now, and really important and vital to the state's economy, the state's livelihood, the schools, of course, and keeping taxes low. So,
yeah, it's interesting. And is it a little unique as a funding mechanism for schools having come from another state? I don't recall that we had such a thing.
Well, I've focused on Idaho ever since I got into the position, so I can't speak directly to others, but receiving lands as endowments at statehood isn't something that's unique. What each state does with it, how their constitution declares that they have to operate thereafter, that probably is somewhat unique from state to state. You know, one of the other things that's important to understand about this is it's not just the land itself either. Several of the land investments from early on that turned into cash have been turned into equity investments now. So there's an entire equity portfolio that goes along with this as well. And then we're also talking about mineral rights in the state and oil and gas leases and things of that nature that can also provide revenues back to the endowments as well. So it goes well beyond just timber on top and cattle on the surface.
I think that allocation of lands to each of the states to benefit the schools was fairly commonplace with the creation of the Western territories, then states, those west of the Mississippi, save for Texas, which had been its own independent republic, and Minnesota, which is split by the Mississippi. So I'm not sure what happened there, Julie. Maybe you'll have to go back and find out and let us know.
I may have to, and then let the listeners know next week. It's a big question now, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's interesting if you look back at how that was originally done. If you go into townships, and they're divided up into squares, and within those squares, each square 1 mile section being a section, the way it was actually laid out is it was the 16th and 36th section in every township, and that was how we got our original endowment land. And ever since, we've been in a process of aggregating and what we call blocking up as we trade, move, and maneuver those lands around and try and get those isolated pockets into the right puzzle piece across the state.
Yeah.
Well, very, very interesting conversation today that's, to use some metaphor, wandered all over the map literally and figuratively. We appreciate your time, Chad. And if ever there are issues that come up from the, either the lands board or the election office or the business side of the Secretary of State, let us know. We're always happy to have you or a representative back on the show.
Thank you and pleasure to be with you.
Yeah.
You're very welcome. Well, this has been, listeners of KRFY, this has been Community Conversations. We've had the pleasure of talking with Chad Houck, who is the Chief Deputy for the Secretary of State down in Boise, and we've had a great talk. Thank you, Chad.
Thank you, ma'am.